It's a Sunday afternoon. Welcome again to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Today's show features the very special, inimitable Robert Bly reading at Asheville's Dinah Wortham Theater from March 28th of this year. Bly has been one of the leading lights of poetry in these states since the publication of Silence in the Snowy Fields in, I think it was 1962. This reading features him celebrating the publication of his most recent volume of translations from the Persian of the Iranian poet Hafez. He's accompanied throughout the reading by the musicians of Free Planet Radio, Chris Rosser, River Gregorian, and Elliot Wadopian. Here we go.
So we have three other poets I want to do for you, and I think I'll do this one, and then we'll have a break and come back and do a couple more. The three poets are Hafez and Rumi and Mirbai, or Hafez and Mirbai and Rumi. I mean, we're talking about the soul. And some of the translations Coleman has done of Rumi are absolutely marvelous things. So, but we'll begin with Hafez. And this is a wonderful day for me because this book just arrived outside. I'd never seen it before. I mean, I've seen one copy, but that's all. And this is Hafez. It's called The Angels Knocking on the Tavern Door. And Hafez is from Iran. And when Coleman and I went to Iran last year, we went to Hafez's grave. He lived around 1450, somewhere near. But everyone loves Hafez in Iran. They have Hafez on the dining room. Rumi's okay, but Hafez, whoa. So everyone has a copy of Hafez on the table, his collected works, the 450 poems he wrote, very elaborate ones. And they use it the way we use the I Ching. You know, if your daughter's thinking of marrying some stupid guy, you check the I Ching, you know? You check Hafez and he'll tell you. And that's the way they do that. So there's no one in our tradition that is loved as much as they love Hafez. And so we went early in the morning to Hafez's grave in Tehran. And it's kind of a park, and there are beautiful pillars there, and his tomb is down there, the stone and everything. And so we just sat down there writing bad poems, you know, and enjoying ourselves. And about 7:30 in the morning, the children started to come. The third grade class came, and they stood around Hafez's stone and sang a song of Hafez. So you see, the thing is that I said to Coleman, wouldn't it be great if we could do that at Whitman's grave? I mean, why shouldn't American children come to Whitman's grave? Isn't that right? So, but we're so dumb, you know? We just leave them out in some damn cemetery somewhere. I don't know where he is, even. But of course, they can also sing, and we haven't worked at that place yet in which you can't sing Whitman, but he didn't sing it himself. Anyway, we're just talking about that experience. Then we waited, and now the third graders came, a little class, all these little kids standing there, smiling and looking at each other's dresses, and they sing a song of Hafez. This went on all morning. So that's called a country with culture. So, and Iran was lovely, really. We'd walk down the street, and people come up to us and say, "Oh, you're Americans, we love Americans." And they meant it, they love Americans. The government doesn't, but they do. So this is one of their fantastic poets, Hafez. Nobody knows much about him. He got in trouble once, apparently, because it's very hard to stay out of trouble in Iran, especially if you shoot your mouth off, which he did all the time. And apparently once the police came to the house and his wife was frightened and she burned about 20 of the poems. But that's the only poems we know that were lost. All right, are you guys ready? This is called The Lost Daughter. All of you, come in right away. That's good. Send out the criers. Go to the marketplace of souls. Hear, hear. All of you in the colony of lovers. Here it is. For several days, the daughter of the wine is reported lost. That's a little reference to wine, which the Muslims don't want you to deal with, as well as some good-looking women. They're not sure about that either. For several days now, the daughter of the wine is reported lost. Call your friends. Whoever is near her is in danger. Her dress is ruby-colored. Her hair is done in seafoam. She takes away reason. Be alert. Watch out for her. If you find this bitter one, you can have my soul for dessert. If she's in the underworld, then that's the place to go. She's a night woman, blameless, disreputable, and red. If you do find her, please bring her to Hafez's house. So it's a tradition with this poem that we don't have in English at all. I'm going to do a couple of poems that are related to the Ghazal of the Ghazal. And the poet mentions his name or her name in the last stanza. And the reason is because this is a culture that for 1,500 years, has been creating great poems, and they don't publish. They memorize. So someone will give a poem of Hafez and way out in the country, and the next day it'll be sung in a bar in Iran. And the only way they can say whose poem it is if the Rumi and Hafez get the habit of putting their name in the last stanza. So that's a meaning for that. When the one I love accepts the wine, it could be a woman, but it could be God. When was the last time you offered a glass of wine to God? And isn't it, I'm a Protestant, we don't do that much. When the one I love accepts the wine, then the shop of the false idols falls down. I have dropped in a heap on the earth crying, in the hope that I'll feel the touch of his hand. I have dropped in a heap on the earth, crying, in the hope that I'll feel the touch of his hand. I have fallen like a fish into deep water, in the hope that the friend will catch me in his net. I have fallen like a fish into deep water, in the hope that the friend will catch me in his net. Whoever looks into his luminous eyes cries, someone is already drunk at the police. How blessed is the man who, like Hafez, has tasted in his heart the wine made before Adam. How blessed is the man who, like Hafez, has tasted in his heart the wine made before Adam. I love that, don't you? Fantastic. So it is true, you don't want to compare, but Emily Dickinson tasted the wine made before Adam. Is this true? Well, if it's true, say yes.
Yes!
What a dopey gun. Did Whitman taste the wine made before Adam?
Yeah.
Yes! Thank you, that felt good. All right, let's do this one. The Dust of the Doorway. I'm not about to abandon love. Nor the secret witness. Nor the cup of wine. I've sworn off these things 100 times. And I won't do it again. I won't agree either that the garden of paradise and the shade trees of heaven and the dancing of playful angels are as good as the ragged dust of your street. Everything the great teachers have to say amounts to a single hint. I've already dropped that hint once. I won't drop it again. The only time I receive any grasp of the state of my own mind is when, lying flat, I can't lift my head from the tavern door. Now, the Muslims say, mustn't do that. You get in trouble. The counselor spoke contemptuously to me. He said, wine is forbidden, period. I agree with you, I said. Also, I don't listen to every jackass. Don't stay here, the angry sheikh said. And by the way, give up, love. And he said, there's no need, brother, for a fight here. I simply won't do that. The poverty I have is right for me. I don't go up in the pulpit and flirt and throw glances to the beautiful young women who are present. Hafez, the arch door of the Zoroastrian master is the site of wealth and abundance. As for kneeling, kissing the dust of that doorway, I will keep on doing that. To spend even one moment grieving about this world is a waste of time. Let's go and sell our robes for ordinary wine. Who says robes are better than wine? In the crooked alleys where the wine sellers hang out, a prayer mat might not even buy one glass of wine. What does that say about prayer mats? Can you feel this flavor? He's always right on the edge. They're about to arrest him. The tavern keeper scolded me and says, saying I should turn my face away from the door. Why is this? The dust on the door sill has more value than the head. Hidden inside the crown of a king, there's always a fear of assassination. A crown is a stylish hat, but a head is too much to pay for it. Nice. The crown is a stylish hat, but the head is too much to pay for it. It's better to turn your face away from all your admirers. The joy the general receives from dominating the world is not worth the suffering of the army. It's best to aim, as Hafez does, for contentment and abandon what belongs to the low world. One grain of indebtedness in the base life weighs more than 100 bushels of gold. All right, so that's a little bit of Hafez.
If you've ever known poets, you know they can have a tendency to run a little late sometimes. So here we are. It's another Sunday afternoon, I know. And we are live.
On Poet Time.
On Poet Time. That's right. That's right. This is your host, Jeff Davis. I'm in the studio today with Laura Hope Gill.
Hello.
And Glynis Redmond.
It's good to be here. Hey, Jeff.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And I hear rumors that Sebastian Matthews is also on the way. So who knows?
Yeah, he's on Poet Time as
He's on Poet Time as well. It's the holidays. And I understand you guys write poems. Is that a fact?
Have you been writing poems, Laura?
We live, Jeff. We live life, and occasionally we write a poem.
Oh, okay.
I've heard rumors. That
something like that. That's what we do. And last night, Glennis hosted the most wonderful little Kwanzaa gathering. And it was such beautiful celebration. And it was a beautiful, there was a beautiful circle of giving where everybody presented, or many people presented poems that they had written. Wow. And her sister sang an amazing rendition of Lean On Me.
Lean On Me, a classic oldie.
And I don't know if I'd actually like completely settled into the holiday spirit until last night.
Oh.
Oh, well,
that's
good.
It's beautiful for you to say that.
It's really lovely.
Yeah.
And it's good to finally get there. I mean, you know, you're only a couple days after Christmas, so that's not
well.
Bad. I don't think I'm there yet. Maybe by New Year's.
I think Sebastian's coming in, so.
Actually, that's AJ, who has the show following this one.
Okay.
So, but anyway, we'll let her in.
Yeah. All right.
She must. And there's Sebastian, too, so we've got a full crowd here.
Everybody's coming in.
Everybody's coming in.
Wasn't it supposed to start around 2:30?
Yeah, welcome on Poet's Time, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Hello. This wild Kwanzaa party I went to, I couldn't.
It's all being blamed on me. Yeah.
That's right.
I told you to stay away from the punch.
All Glenn's fault.
Do you guys know Ryan?
Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
I don't know Ryan.
Laura, Glenn's.
Yeah.
Nice to meet
and,
you.
And we're live and on the air. So welcome, Sebastian. There's Sebastian. joining the herd here now. We've got a full house all of a sudden.
It's fabulous. And
all victims of a Kwanzaa party.
I had none of the punch. I had none of the punch.
A likely story.
He didn't. I really actually, he had water. I can vouch for him.
Right,
but another thing that we do as poets is we like to eat, Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
And we eat, and occasionally we write a poem. And the food last night
was good.
Oh.
It was Glennis.
Jeanette.
Glennis' mom, Jeanette, as in Jeanette, my mama is magic. And there's this scene in the movie Big Night where the two brothers, the Italian brothers, fix this meal and it's their last ditch effort to save their restaurant.
But they've been totally conned too, right?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. They're telling everyone
they were never going to save it.
Levi, who's coming, Louis Prima is coming to sing. And we cook this amazing, amazing meal, timbales and pastas and soups. And people, while they're eating, come to life. And this one woman bursts into tears. And the chef says, "What's wrong? Why are you crying?" And she says, "My mother was a terrible cook." She realized that she never in her life tasted such magnificent food. And my mother's not a terrible cook.
No, she's not. I can vouch for that.
Jeanette is absolutely an amazing cook, and it was wonderful.
Carries it to a different level, way.
That's right.
I brought home some of the sweet potato pie.
Oh, ooh, did you really? Yeah. Thank you. It was a Glennis Redman and Jeanette Redman production. The main ingredient was love.
There it was.
And a lot of leftovers. I don't know who's going to eat them. How about a poem?
Yeah. Hey, this is allegedly a poetry show.
Oh, really?
Everybody, I don't know about
the sign
you.
On the door said.
I can sit and talk about my mom all day. Actually, the best part of the Kwanzaa for me was like cooking in the kitchen with her all day long. Yeah. And looking up at one moment and just saying, I could do this with you forever. There was no words. It was just kind of like this whole like dance that was going on. She wasn't giving me any instructions. She was just doing her thing. I was doing my thing. And we were just hands moving one across the other.
That's
and it was
nice.
Just a gift. And she's 73 now. And I just.
She's awesome.
Every memory we can create. I'm up for it. And so the theme for the party last night was ancestors. And it was really beautiful to see all the ancestors, seeing Laura's grandmother right there and Sebastian's father, Bill Matthews, right next to my dad. Which
wasn't that cool?
That
pictures?
Was amazing, yeah. You know, with your father's love of music and my father being a musician.
Yeah.
Just so many worlds that you
can't. So many pictures on that table and so many stories that people told
exactly
about them. It was. I felt bad taking my picture off when I left.
I know when people left. I know it was really. But you have to take your ancestors with you. Yeah. But it was also beautiful to hear Peggy Baldwin, who's my agent and friend, who doesn't. She's a very shy person and doesn't like to read in public.
Yeah.
And I think this is like the second time I've ever heard her read in public.
It was nice.
Yesterday. And she wrote a poem about her mother.
It was really nice.
It was beautiful.
And Sharon read a poem or two of hers, recited them.
Yes.
Laura read two poems.
Yeah,
it was a fun night.
Yeah, it was a really nice. I was going to read this poem that has to do with ancestry, and particularly ancestry in North Carolina. That it's not my direct lineage, but I kind of own it because it's like this stories that don't get told, and it's about the people of the Kingdom of Happy Land that's right out by Green River in not far from here. And pretty much the story is that a band of slaves walked from Mississippi to North Carolina, 500 miles. And this is a little poem I wrote for them.
They settled in Green River?
They right outside of Green River, and they called it Kingdom of Happy Land.
Huh.
And they had it for 25 years, and they were a self-sustaining community for
when
that
long. When is this? What year?
Years? It was right
after the war.
Slaves were emancipated.
It's the first hippie commune.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I don't know
that
if they would
Black
call
Mountain.
Themselves a hippie commune.
That
but
in Black Mountain.
It was definitely, but you know, that energy.
Yeah.
He felt like he was called there. And then as they walked from Mississippi to North Carolina, slaves would keep joining them,
sure.
You know, so they were this ragtag bunch, you know,
mm-hmm.
by the time they got to Green River. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that Green River area pretty well. Do you know exactly where it was? Was it close to Tuxedo?
It's further up. It's not Tuxedo. It's
further
north.
Up the river?
Yeah, it's a little further north than that.
Yeah.
It's a private property now, mm-hmm. and so someone who knew the people who own the land let me walk around. There's only like a little few things that are left from that time.
Huh.
So I've written a series of poems. This one's a short one called...
I'll have to get you to take me there sometime.
Okay, yeah, it would be
read
great.
Read the poem.
Okay.
This is, after all, allegedly a poem.
The sign on the door said, Minister of Funny Walks. I didn't really know.
Well, that would be us. Okay. Footnotes. Where does history go when it hasn't been tended to? I say it grows wild amongst the periwinkle, the turkey foot fern, and my mind. There it is, right alongside my heavy heart, like that mass of stones left on a hill, the only remnants left of the kingdom, speaking of mountain royalty. King Robert and Queen Luella, leased for 10 cents a day by a Civil War widow named Serpta. Their rule over 200 acres of chopping, hauling, and toting. I understand this urgency, the need of self-appointment. I hear it in the restless wind on the ridge, or are those ancestral voices crying out about the uneasy quilt stitch hearsay of their lives being left to myth and lore? Where does history go when it dies? When corn cribs and makeshift houses no longer riddle the mountain slopes, and 40 years of hands culling comfrey into a healing balm along with gospel songs cease. This silent edge is where I live, filled with heartache, remembering history and where it goes without a foothold.
That's a nice poem.
Nice. And that is from your new book, right?
It will be in the new book. Right now, it's been published in Appalachian Heritage, but it will be in the new book because I'll have a series of those poems in the new book coming out. It's not in Under the Sun. It will be in the new book coming out, Tributary.
Excellent. Good to know. Good to know. Yeah. Good. Well, Laura, what have you been up to? Aside from eating and, you know, going to Kwanzaa parties.
Right now I'm kind of stunned by the line, where does history go when it dies?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm obsessed with that.
And
that very question has been on my mind with WordFest, which is what I've been up to.
Yes.
And our idea that poetry is news and journalism and... it is a way of keeping history from dying, I hope. And that's a very interesting... It would keep it circulating.
The news that stays news.
Right.
I mean, really, the real question is, what... You know, there's so many stories. Like, you know, all of us have stories. And if we're not witnessing and it's not put on paper and it's not passed down orally, then, you know, I feel like it still impacts us. And right. I think it's like the role of the poet, really, you know, the role of the artist. I would even be more general, you know, about yeah. that, to bring this yeah. so it doesn't get lost. I mean, right. I feel like it's not lost because it's around us all the time and we're being impacted. But if we're not conscious of it, what does that mean?
And part right. of it is, I think, that, you know, there's so many different cultures within a time cult period and the big culture, but so that those have to be all represented. But it's our take on what's happening all the time
right.
that needs to be remembered, because it will tell us as much about that time period later as anything else. I think of that great writer for the New York Times who writes those little mini, he writes his own pieces, but he has them in the New York Times, like Vern Krinkenborg, whatever his name is. They're like these tiny 10 paragraph pieces or 8 paragraph pieces about just observing the smallest things. And it's like, that is citizens journalism. It's just right. this incredible, it's not poetry, but it's pretty close in my mind. It's as close mm-hmm. as prose gets, you know.
It's reporting on the subtle and in yeah. mm-hmm. This age of the dawning of the age of Aquarius, when the subtle is becoming more talked about, the idea that there are little quanta that are making us up and things like that. It's also the time for poetry to be rising as well as news. And that's why the Poetry Foundation and the Columbia University School of Journalism gave a symposium on this. Mm-hmm. And I think they're thinking, they're still framing certain poems as journalism, poems mm-hmm. that are influenced by the journalistic style. Mm-hmm. And we're a little bit different from that, and that we're saying it's all news, and we're not the first to say it. Like you said, it's news that stays news. But we are going up. There are poets who have said that it's difficult to get the news from poems, and we're challenging that. And it's the news that sustains, and it's the news that witnesses what otherwise is not being seen. It's also like poetry anthology then becomes something of a news document with so many different perspectives inside it. It's like holding a globe, a news globe, rather than a news line. You know, Palestinian poets, just Northern Irish poems and poets. So that's what I've been obsessing with lately.
Lots and of prisons, yeah.
We're starting to write the grants for 2010. Mm-hmm. And
Since 2009 is coming up very soon, why don't you go ahead and, do you know the dates yet for
April? I know everything.
Yeah, okay. Well, why don't you tell the people out in
Of course you know everything.
There are a few things that you forget, but...
What did you say?
There are a few things that you forget.
And that's why I have Sebastian and Glennis.
Yeah, we got your back.
April 30th, May 3rd will be WordFest 2009. We're still working on venue. Okay. And the poets are...
Quincy Troop. At Small Forward. Coming
Lee
from
Young Lee,
Lee Young Lee,
Valjanaya Mort, Frank X. Walker,
Patrick Wassell, Ross Gay, Elizabeth Bradfield,
whose book Liz. Transformative Work is from Arctoy Press.
Red Hen.
From Red Hen. Yeah. And Red Hen started a gay lesbian press, seeing that a lot of gay lesbian bookstores and publications were not making it, and so she started a subsidiary, and Transformative Work is the first.
She was reading here recently at the Flood Gallery.
She read Panel Props also.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
So local writers, Holly Iglesias, who I brought some of her poems to read today, Gary Lilly, Keith Flynn, Thomas Rancrow and the Boat Rockers.
Pat Revere Seal. And also Doris Davenport will be coming up.
Eckway.
And pardon me?
Who's the woman from the Native American poet?
Deborah Kingsland Forrest.
Yes.
And she's coming over from Cherokee. She writes in Cherokee.
Hmm.
And will read
Leanne
in Cherokee.
Brown.
So we're getting it's all build up. We've got the schedule, and that will be coming out soon online. The website is taking a little bit longer than I had anticipated, but it ought to be up hopefully this week. And if you want to, how we're doing this, we got funded by the very, very, very generous North Carolina Arts Council and the North Carolina Humanities Council.
North Carolina Humanities Council is the most humane organization. It's incredible, run by Harlan Graydon. And none of this would be possible, by the way, without Maine, who's our sponsor, and we're a little outreach agent of Maine. However, we're still in need of about, something to the tune of about $7,000, $8,000. And to raise this, you can help us by sponsoring a poet. And on right now, you can go to www.brwm.org. That's the Blue Ridge Marketplace set up by Maine. And it allows e-commerce for people that don't have e-commerce on their website. And it's set up so that you can sponsor a poet whose work you adore. And I have right now up there, I have $50 up there. And you're not buying a ticket, you're sponsoring a poet. And when the poet comes, I will print out a list of all the people who donated money for that poet. And so that poet will know that you love their work. And I don't know, maybe join you for coffee. We'll see. But this is how we're doing it. And so that's how WordFest is happening. I hope that you will go there. And soon AshevilleWordFest.org will be up, hopefully this week. Mm-hmm. And you should
What's
be able to donate.
What's the URL there. On the current site?
AshevilleWordFest.org.
No, on the marketplace site.
BRWM.org.
BRWM.org.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the place.
It's like Blue Ridge Workplace Market or something. Wally started it. It's brilliant. Mm-hmm. They're really brilliant work. And so that's what I've been doing. I've also been writing poems, and I have one.
Well, why don't you read one?
This one's called Magnify. It's new, and it's about my grandfather, and I wrote it for Glennis's Kwanzaa party. For James Shaver. I want to live every moment as a promise, unbroken and flowing, to my grandfather who, when we walked to the water pump in the park in Orillia, looked up and announced in his French-Canadian ancestry's tongue, Quel mélange de couleurs. And I asked him what he'd said, and he, being deaf and understanding the question to mean I hadn't heard him, repeated it en français, and I somehow understood him the second time and didn't need to hear it the third. Language is its own water underneath the earth of thought. From his deafness, now my deafness, he only spoke to illuminate, to magnify some lost treasure the rest of us were missing. Family arguments died under the blade of a Shakespeare quote. Rough waters calmed. You going to be a poet, pet? He asked as we clipped the wet laundry onto the line between their cottage and the next. There was only one correct answer, and I said it. Cool cotton, heavy in my hands one minute, dancing in the sunlight the next. Genius, he called me after Alzheimer's had stolen my name. Poet, he stroked my hands as I tried to feed him cranberry juice through a straw he refused. I watched prose dissolve into poetry under the overwhelming tide of mind loss, beginning the moment he locked his keys in the car without setting the brake, so it rolled into the ocean. He stood and watched it, then announced, "We'll be walking home today, pet." There is, he told me years before, an eloquence to silence. Perhaps my hardest lesson as we knelt in the canoe and pushed off from the Simcoe beach, the water droplets our paddles carried over the surface, the only sound, a whirlpool's hush from a J-stroke kept us straight. In the silence, he taught me the depth of life, interminable, exhausting. Those evenings we paddled for hours, and when we returned, I had the golden feeling of nothing having happened of value, but he would assure me in his long, wordless strides something beautiful had.
So lovely.
There's, I think why I love poetry, why I love to read it and write it, is that there are really good poetry. The poetry that makes you wake up is full of surprises, and visual and verbal, and there are like so many in this poem where you just like laugh or you see it and then a couple times where you see it we see it, and then you name it, and we see it again. Mm. And so there's a sense of language running over the ground, and hearing him twice, not having to hear a third time. It's like this poem is very layered, and it's beautiful.
Thank you. I love language. Mm-hmm. Is its own water underneath the earth.
Yeah. Damn you for writing that and not me.
I didn't hear that water running. I'm sorry.
I wanted to write it. I want
he wants that line.
I want that.
He's
going to steal that line. Yes. Yeah.
No, it's
maybe we'll all steal it. We can all write poems.
Everybody write a poem using that line.
But it's something that, I don't know, I've been writing about losing my hearing for a long time, and Poppy introduced me to poetry. He would sit me down. I'd spend these summers at their cottage, and the cottage was filled with books. There was like a sink, and there was books. Mm-hmm. And he would sit me down with a book, and I was by reading for that month or whatever, and it would be King Lear when I was like 10 or 12. And the Bronte sisters.
Jumping right in.
Who got me. Yeah. And so he really exposed me to language, and then he was also the one who was deaf, and he was always silent. And so when I lost my hearing, I started losing my hearing and began that journey. I was like, okay, Poppy, my gosh, what a potent figure in my life. He gave me both language and the inability to hear it. Mm-hmm. And so the metaphors of silence when I speak of him or when I speak of hearing loss and how eloquent it is. This poem, I think, was the culmination of years of writing about hearing loss and wondering about Poppy.
Well, you're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, a broadcast service of the Mountain Area Information Network. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Joining me in the studio today, we are live and in person, Glennis Redmond, Laura Hope Gill, Sebastian Matthews, and another person whose name I don't
know. Brian Walsh.
Brian Walsh.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He wandered in off the street. He's just been.
We know he's an itinerant poet.
He brought a poem. So
there you go.
Yeah.
He's definitely qualified. So, Sebastian, what have you been up to?
Thanks, Jeff. Hanging out with Ryan, talking about Rivendell. Ryan and I do Rivendell together, this journal that's been kind of dead in the water for a while, but we've resurrected it, and that's been exciting. And hanging out with my boy and my wife.
Yeah.
We didn't light candles last night for Hanukkah because we lit a Kwanzaa candle. So it was it's been a nice time to kind of be weaving. Went and visited a friend's Christmas tree because we wanted Avery to see that. Big old-fashioned tree with the lights. Oh, yeah. Candles, actually.
Yeah. Wow.
German style.
Yeah.
So we've been enjoying the holidays and talking poetry, reading poetry. I thought I'd read a couple poems, if you don't mind.
Yeah, yeah.
One is from...
What a good idea.
I used to be on this show. Holly Iglesias.
You all did.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened? Souvenirs of a Shrunken World is her book. It's a Corey Press First Book Award winner, 2008, and Holly is a beloved and local poet and a great poet with a second book coming out already. It's amazing. So I thought I'd read the first book. It's a book of poems that are set around the Chicago World's Fair, 1904. It's prose poems, and they're a mosaic, and there's some great illustrations, and they kind of tell this big tapestry story around the World's Fair. I'll read you the first one. Running for the Fair, a Stereograph. She uses a lot of photographs and images from research to trigger her poems. Running for the Fair, a Stereograph. Shaken from a dream about hobos, a boy hightails it through the garden towards the tracks, his stride lengthening with the pace of escape. Henhouse, slop pot, icebox, cheesecloth, past and future, neck and neck. Air expanding with yeast in the kitchen, a girl cools her pulse at the pump and stares at the rhubarb, the peas, the sausage casings in a basin. She hears the train, bolts to watch it pass, cars strobing the cornfields into her picture show. And the poems work like that. They're like that long. They work very with a real solid image, beautiful voice, and then just next one.
An interesting thing about this collection, this World's Fair that she's writing about, and she's coming to WordFest, by the way. She's phenomenal. And at this World's Fair, they brought in
real live Indian tribes.
Yeah, and natives from around the world and set up a village, like a series of villages in this expo. And in the book, there are these photographs of these women all in their corsets and their ruffles and their Victorian white stuff, walking next to pygmies. Mm-hmm. And it's just...
it's a horrible zoo in some ways. And it's horrible. It's like, it really was a bad move.
And there's a piece in here with, I don't know if it's in here, Hollywood, tell me about it. Helen Keller was there. Mm-hmm. And they had a prince of a tribe allowed her and only her to touch his hair and touch his face. And so a very striking moment in history to look at.
Mm-hmm. I'll read you another one of them.
Yeah.
New century, new woman, new St. Louis. Were it not for our dedication to municipal housekeeping, the World's Fair visitor might take home a memory of coal smoke and unpaved streets. Had we no concern for the loose glass, tenements by the station might have remained rubbish piles. Had the Civic Improvement League simply busied itself with the box suppers and quilting bees, the water might still be sludge, the color of a Morgan Street quadroon. Instead, we have launched an era of moral awakening. And as you can hear, these are different voices speaking these, and that's the voice of someone working there. I'll read you one more, mm-hmm. and then I'll... because these... I know I'm flipping through the book to some of my favorites. The Entertainers. Joplin admonishes the parlor pianist, "Slow down!" While up and down Market Street, clubs explode with players who define prowess in terms of speed. At the Rosebud Cafe, syncopators feed on gossip and cutting contests as they wait for messengers dispatched to hire them. Black and white alike may fear it, but ragtime's the rage, even if it does scramble the brain and corrupt youth. So there was a lot of Elvis before Elvis.
Oh, yes, there's always been Elvis. The Elvis archetype at work. Well, those are nice. Those are nice, yeah.
It's a good book, and it's worth taking a look at. It's at Malaprops and other bookstores. And
mm-hmm. What's the name of the book again?
The Souvenirs of a Shrunken World. Mm-hmm. And it has the most wild picture on the front with artichokes.
Mm-hmm. And the author
again? I think it's a beautiful
Holly
picture.
Iglesias.
Iglesias.
Okay.
Love it.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So what about your own work? What have you been up to?
Not much.
Oh, yeah. Have you been editing more, doing more editing than writing?
No, I've been writing, working on poems, working on a prose book, mm-hmm. Top Secret.
Yeah.
And doing WordFest with Laura.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, doing art projects with my boy Avery.
Yeah, good. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That keeps you busy. What is Rivendell still place based?
It's outer space.
Outer space
based now. It's kind of a right Parliament on. Funkadelic. No, it's it is place based.
Sign me up.
Yeah, exactly. Space is the place. It is, and we had a Pacific Northwest issue that was supposed to come out, and we didn't really get it done, and we ran out of money.
Yeah,
and.
As happens,
and we thought we'll hold on it, and then we've just come up with some new ideas, and maybe Ryan, who's going to read a poem, I hope, can say a few things about it. We just came up with a cool idea, thinking about a journal in part called Cave Wall, which is a great journal based out of Greensboro, and seeing what an elegant, small journal can do, and Rivendell is usually the opposite of that.
It's like
huge,
a 300-page behemoth.
Yeah, kind of all over the place, drunken uncle of a journal.
Yeah, and it really has been more in hibernation than in outer space or dead. So it's winter, so we're hibernating. Yeah. We're allowed to do that.
We're mammals.
Yeah.
It's a mammal, I guess, too. Rivendell is a mammal.
And with this economy, time and money have helped us decide to simplify. Right. So the next issue, we hoped, will be more of a 48 to 72 page sort of portfolio of the best poetry we've received, and focus just on poetry, with some black and white artwork, but that's round one. With a little more time and money, round two will feature a particular circle within the poetry scene right now in Portland, Oregon. Really, a couple friends of ours seem to be in the nexus of that, and we hope to collect work from them and a few other friends of theirs, mentors and colleagues, and really make an issue around that one circle of friends, which has always been part of the spirit of Rivendell, is a place, but also the circles of people within a place.
And then if we're lucky and have energy and we don't get hit by a bus, we'll do another one that would be, or combine with just the dispatches, small prose pieces from the present day around Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. And then we'll see if we mix that or not with archive work. So in a sense, do a Rivendell in four little sections, mm-hmm. kind of thinking about Little Bolero, how they had their main magazine, but they had these kind of portfolio things that they did. And then maybe make a box for subscribers, and in the end, just like put all four in that box, mm-hmm. and that becomes the issue. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we're thinking about.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
I think a lot of journals right now and a lot of presses are doing exactly what you're doing, and are trying to reconfigure what they've been
calibrate.
Doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Ryan, you're going to read us a poem?
That's right. Yeah. I was about to say.
Sure. It's all fair, right?
That's right.
Sitting here listening, and I'd planned mainly to listen, so this is great. I'm struck by the family line, so I thought I'd read one about my family. It's from my great-grandfather. It's called The Field. We're down 7-2, and I've been watching fog creep into the outfield from behind me, thinking about the way summer has slowly made a ghost of itself. And when the big guy with the neck tattoo, who's already scorched a double down the third base line, nails another one toward me, I'm not ready. There's no fence to keep the ball from rolling into the deep and unmowed corners of the park. So I follow it there, looking for the grass-stained Spalding my dad and I threw back and forth and back until dusk, so as to keep out of Papaw Carter's house that smelled of death, which is to say, it smelled of urine and of raw chicken thawing on the kitchen counter, and the years of mineral oil worked into the dark wood furniture of the living room. One of Papaw's farm cats slinks by, splash of blood on its white face, and I'm looking for the ball, keeping my eyes away from the house and the man in the house who shares my blood, whose purpled toes had to be cut off to save the left foot, whose purblind pony paced a circle in the bare grass, whose papery voice was kept thin under blankets in August. When he dies, Mom says his heart will fly home to Jesus, and I picture the bloody form like the red bird the cat dragged into the dooryard, rising over the farm, over the low gray skies of Prunnytown, vanishing beyond the mountains. Papaw died in a room with the TV on mute. I can't recall what happened to that swayback pony, nor the ball, nor even where to find the plot of earth where he's buried. Someone is crying home as the big guy rounds third. Home! I leg it out to the taller grasses, now damp with end of summer evening, and there in the grass is the ball. Home. It seems impossibly far.
Mm. Nice.
Awesome. Nice.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I love that ending.
Mute.
It's like, the throw hasn't been made, never will be made. Yeah, good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Channeling B.H. Fairchild there a little bit, if you know his work.
Wonderful. That makes, as I say, it makes the ordinary extraordinary, and by the end, that home is immense, isn't it?
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, Glennis.
Yes.
We'll go round robin.
Oh, here. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Back to you.
Do I? To me?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, indeed.
This poem is called I Lost the Baby. I lost the baby, not in couldn't find, but in perished. I lost my child and I still was in search. He found me in my bed, busy with dreaming. I lost my child, blonde hair, hazel eyes, skin really fair. He found me in my bed, busy with dreaming. Kissing me awake though I was still asleep. Blonde hair, hazel eyes, skin really fair, shining like a familiar sun. kissing me awake though I was still asleep. He said, Mom, I will tell Amber and Celeste there's no school snow, shining like a familiar sun. How did he find us since we've moved three times? He said, Mom, I will tell Amber and Celeste there's no school snow. Bedside, you stood like a 12-year-old angel that I named Cameron. How did you find us since we moved three times? Since I've seen him, our home is more whole than it's ever been. Bedside, he stood like a 12-year-old angel that I named Cameron, his quiet glow gleaming. I'm not lost, Mom. I'm here. I'm still here.
That's nice. I remember you read that at Westwood when we did the reading.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Very. And it's actually, is it a pantoum?
It's a pantoum.
I was going to say.
It's a pantoum.
Yeah. It had that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the repetitions. They work so well there.
They're subtle.
You use the form so well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Makes a real, real fine poem there, girl.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yes, Laura.
Before I knew she was going to read that one, I also have a poem on things that have gone on, creatures and beings that have gone on before. And this is a couple of weeks ago, over the course of 3 days, my family experienced the death of 2 guinea pigs and a baby bunny. Mm. And it was 3 days of heartbreak.
Yeah.
And so this is... And I had my daughter, I had sent her out to be with her father when I realized the guinea pigs were sick. And I knew we were in for a rough time. So this is called On a Child-Friendly Theology of Animals Dying. And I wrote it while I was trying to figure out how to tell
love
my child.
Love those long titles. You hit me every single time.
On a Child-Friendly Theology of Animals Dying. One... It is tempting to tell her that God wanted a pet, and that is why in the afternoon he crept into the playroom and made the guinea pig sick, or in the night made the rabbit hop so much she toppled her cage, and that is how she broke her neck. To turn God into the taker of animals, who sits in high heaven on a cloud-bound throne, one finger to his temple, and one hand stroking a sea of small furried creatures extending eternally from his lap. 2. God is also the smallest animal, a guinea pig who can also contract an infectious bacteria that causes him to convulse, poop a lot, and in a few short deep breaths let his head drop back in your hand. It is God's way of renewing himself, of keeping everything in motion, so when we grieve the loss, the large and small ones, we feel his loss, hold ourselves in his immense but helpless hands.
Nice. Yes.
Good poem. This is a poem by a man, young man named Sam Taylor. It's from a book called The Body of the World. And the poem is also in a new book called The Osable Reader, which is from Osable Press, which is just now folding and reconfiguring into Copper Canyon.
Oh, wow.
In a very, very good relationship, a very great way, I think, for authors to be moved on and kept in a catalog and given a chance to keep going. So Chase Twitchell does an amazing work there and is moving on to some better work and, you know, just doing the next thing. So it's a great anthology with poems by Gary Copeland Lilly and Steve Orlin and Charlie Simic and, you know, just incredible range of writers, including Linton Kwesi Johnson, who's such a great dub poet, and other poems. So this is a poem called The Accident, or just Accident, by Sam Taylor. A beacon moving through the darkest crime scene, my friend said, when I told him I didn't know what love was. 2 months later, Joel woke up reclined in a truck that had no doors or windshield. His left shoe missing, the driver's seat beside him empty. Somebody was calling his name. No, not his name, just calling him. So precisely, it tugged his sternum like a name, He rose, walked around the vehicle. The tires were gone, two wheels stripped to their axles. And there she was, on the ground, sitting against the truck, legs outstretched. He felt relieved. She must have collapsed, pouting at herself, sheepish for the mess she'd caused. Where was the road? He heard it humming in the distance. He leaned down to her, but she did not move. He was terrified then of the silence he felt that moment, which was not quite of trees or the moon or of hot tea, but the silence of somewhere else, of a lake being where a girl should be. I didn't ask him if he saw a beacon in that field, the windshield shattered 60 yards away, the sky a frigid wishing well. I imagine what he would have to say, waking in the twisted metal, dark, walking around the Ford to find her sitting in the grass, already gone, her suitcase open 50 feet away. That there was no beacon, just taillights and windows scattered in the weeds, the truck's steel carcass and the stars they had shared, now his alone, tickling her shell. The beacon was nowhere. He was the beacon. He would have to say, standing alone, his pulse snapping against the sky, filling the veins of the night, plasma, cartilage, bone, crying out for her, her jacket flapping in the bush. He would have to say that love does not mean preservation alone, but also creation and destruction, and only then is a thing complete. Is it revealed, like the windshield shattered 60 yards away, like Somayaya dead, sitting calmly in the grass after the truck she crashed flipped over 15 times? Some things are impossible and they come true. Maybe all things. 2 days later, he returned to the road, found a 2-inch groove that trailed into the scrub, followed it, picking up his wallet, a cell phone, her water bottle, a letter he had written, but her last summer, half rain bled. The truck towed and gone, he found her spilled menstrual pad still caught in the sumac, left them, sobbing. I imagine what he would have to say, that there is no thing that is not a beacon, no thing that is not a flag in a mute's hand trying to reach us, or a window holding a face. And except in some spots the face shines through more than others, like in Somaya alive, or like that night as he leaned over her, noticing her left foot in the grass was bare like his own. And 2 days later, when his father drove him back, he found, on a sun-washed hill beneath a tall pine, her boot, standing upright, still laced, and tied.
Who was that?
Sam Taylor. What blows me away about that poem is there's this remove. It's the friend talking about the friend's story about his love.
Right.
And her death is being told empathetically, imaginatively, mm-hmm. and then he's kind of repeating it through a couple different tellings of the story. None of that remove dampens the intensity of the death or disrespects it. In fact, it kind of continues to lift it up.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a beautiful poem. And it's a beautiful book. The book's called The Body of the World.
What was that line about no thing?
No thing is a...
A beacon.
It's a beacon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No thing is a beacon.
Yeah, and then maybe everything is, you know.
Yeah.
Excuse me, guys.
Beautiful.
Jeff, how you doing, man? You got any poems for us in the last 5 minutes?
Nope, we're down to like 1 minute, so I'm going to...
Haiku?
I'll have to take a rain check. We'll do it again. Thanks so much for coming in today, guys. Appreciate it. This has been Wordplay, and we've been entertained today by Glennis Redman, Laura Hope Gill, Sebastian Matthews,
Ryan Walsh.
And Ryan Walsh. Thank you all for coming in.
Go, Laura. Go, Laura.
It's your birthday.
Today is your birthday. People were jamming, 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 jamming. People were jamming, jamming. We were jamming, 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 jamming. People were jamming, jamming. I was on that cruise. It was sailing.